Hi, Dave Emery here. This is For the Record, program number 957. The National Front and French Deep Politics, part 2. This is being recorded on May 4th of the year 2017. With the decisive round in the French elections scheduled for this Sunday, and with the Front National, or National Front of Marine Le Pen, or Le Pen as most people pronounce it, in that runoff, although favored by most to come in a distant second to Emmanuel Macron, we're going to take a look at the National Front, or Front National, its origins, and even more importantly, we're going to take a look at French deep politics and another manifestation of globalization. Globalization took place long before it became something of a catchword in political slash economic discussion. In the introduction to the anti-fascist books for download on the SpitfireList.com website, I go into the relationship between globalization and the rise of fascism. That will be linked in the written description for this show. Suffice it to say that long before transnational corporations began moving factories abroad and engaging in arrangements like NAFTA, big capital had become international, and relationships between large financial and industrial institutions around the world, and including on both sides of national conflicts, that's very important, on both sides of national conflicts, had formed cartel agreements. And that investment policy had much to do with not only the rise of fascism, but about the course of fascism prior to and during World War II, and as we will review again in this program, after the war as well. The National Front has a foundation in French fascist politics and, as we looked at last week, in elements of the Vichy collaborationist government. We began the program last week, for the record 956, by reviewing Steve Bannon's affinity for a French fascist collaborationist named Charles Maurras, whose Action Française was a extreme right-wing French political movement that began in the late 19th century or early 20th century and became part of the Vichy collaborationist government. Maurras was sentenced to prison in France for war for collaboration and war crimes after the war. However, he was released ultimately due to poor health after his death. In the Wikipedia entry for the National Front, and we will be talking about that. That will be linked and excerpted in the program. It mentions that one of the seminal influences on the development of the National Front is l'Action Française of Charles Maurras. Again, one of the ideological influences on Steve Bannon. One of the keys to understanding, I think, not only contemporary, well, politics at all times, but in particular many of the things that I talk about on this program, is to understand that a very good way, maybe the ideal way, of achieving and maintaining political control is to get economic control of key players, and to do so on both sides of a political divide, be that an ideological political divide among political interests in a given country, for example, France, as we're going to talk about, or on the two sides of a national divide, as in France and Germany, before, during, and after World War II, or both sides of a xenophobic slash political dynamic such as the anti-immigrant slash anti-Muslim aspect of the National Front, one of their most important sources of political currency. That also, not incidentally, is a source of political currency to the Trump administration and to Steve Bannon, and there have been contacts between Team Trump and Team Le Pen of the Front National. Now, as we looked at last week, one of the indications that Marine Le Pen's attempt at undemonizing the National Front and divorcing it from its Vichy collaborationist slash fascist foundations became a little ragged or transparent, or hollow might be a better word, when she was dismissive of French participation in the Veldive Roundup in 1942. That was one of the key French roundups of Jews during the Holocaust, and it was effected by René Bousquet, B-O-U-S-Q-U-E-T, one of Heinrich Himmler and the SS's principal collaborators in France, and the fellow who was the Secretary General of the Vichy Police. Most importantly for our purposes here, this French war criminal was not only someone who was very, very close to French socialist President François Mitterrand, the first left-of-center French president of the Fifth Republic, but he also was a key financial source, apparently not only for Mitterrand, but for other left-wing French politicians. I think this should also be weighed against the background of people like Karl Rove and billionaire reactionary hedge fund manager Paul Singer channeling money to Bernie Sanders' campaign as well. And then with Sanders championing Muslim Brotherhood, linked elements for leadership in the Democratic Party, a political goal of the far right is being realized, albeit perhaps unintentionally, by the person I call Saint Bernard. But again, the Karl Rove, Paul Singer money behind the Sanders campaign should be borne in mind here. Reading now from the Wikipedia article or Wikipedia post, Mitterrand and the Far Right, of the relationship between SS Vichy collaborator René Bousquet, whose role in the Veldive Roundup was discounted by Marine Le Pen, and his relationship to François Mitterrand and also to other left-wing politicians. That Wikipedia entry reads as follows. In 1974, René Bousquet gave financial help to François Mitterrand for his presidential campaign against Valéry Giscard d'Estaing. In an interview with Pierre Favier and Michel Martin-Roland, Mitterrand claimed that he was not the only left-wing politician to benefit from Bousquet's money, as René Bousquet helped finance all the principal left-wing politicians from the 1950s to the beginning of the 1970s, including Pierre Mendès France. That is more than a little interesting and also very important, because as we looked at in For the Record 802, it was the very same François Mitterrand who was part of the Croix de Feu and Cagoule milieu that formed the basis of the French Fifth Column, which concretized in the Vichy government. It was François Mitterrand who was instrumental in helping to provide for the establishment of the euro, a currency now shared by the various eurozone countries, and one that replaced the Deutschmark. Now, supposedly, this was done because Mitterrand was worried about French reunification and because this would somehow limit Germany. In fact, that is not exactly the way things worked out. I think the tone in the article in the Business Spectator that I'm about to excerpt should be taken with a grain of salt. However, Robert Zelig, a member of the German Marshall Fund of the U.S., or someone on the board of the German Marshall Fund of the U.S., a key Bormann organization, think tank and pivot of influence in the U.S. Robert Zelig, Zelick, was the lead U.S. official in the negotiations to establish a reunification of Germany, and he was made a Knight Commander of the German Order of Merit, a very high award for a foreign official, for his work in that regard. Reading now from the Business Spectator of August 17th, 2011, an article by Oliver Mark Hartwich, H-A-R-T-W-I-C-H, a Euro power play that backfired, unquote. And I think backfired should be taken with a huge grain of salt. The point being here that it was François Mitterrand, again, part of the French pre-World War II fifth column, and someone who received political financing from René Bousquet, in charge of the SS-linked Vichy security police during World War II. It was René Bousquet who helped to finance not only François Mitterrand's political career, but those of other French left-wing politicians as well. Again, if you really want to control things, getting up in the knickers, so to speak, of both sides of a political divide is the way to do it. For example, in this case, people on the left or nationalists who were worried about German power in the event of German reunification could point to the, quote, left-wing, unquote, François Mitterrand and his role in establishing the euro as a means of rhetorically and ideologically silencing critics, the point being that Mitterrand's efforts, financed in part by René Bousquet, come from the, quote, left, unquote. From this article of the genesis of the euro and its results and the role of François Mitterrand in that, we read, skipping down, he, Robert Zelig, explained his understanding of how Europe got its common currency. It was very clear that European monetary union resulted from French-German tensions before unification and was meant to calm Mitterrand's fears of an all-too-powerful Germany. According to Zelig, the euro currency is a byproduct of German unification. In strategic terms, Germany's influence has never been greater. As the continent wants to bank on Germany's AAA rating, Berlin can now effectively dictate fiscal policy to Athens, Lisbon, and Rome, perhaps in the future to Paris, too. It, the euro, has turned the Germans into the new rulers of Europe, and it has consigned France to be the weaker partner in the Franco-German relationship, as we looked at in many programs dealing with the EU. And there will be a link to the first of the Greek tragedy programs. In fact, the European Monetary Union and the euro were the culmination of roughly 1.5 centuries of German economic imperial theory, going back to Friedrich Least and culminating with the Third Reich and the post-World War II Bormann capital network. In order to understand the deep politics underlying much of this, we're going to go back once again to the pre-World War II, actually the World War I period, the pre-World War II period, and the World War II period, and we're going to take a look at another of the manifestations of globalization that was inextricably linked with the rise of fascism. The establishment of the cartel system that was used so advantageously by Germany for its economic warfare, something discussed in Miscellaneous Archive Show M11, and in numerous books on the SpitfireList.com website, available for download for free. We examine how Germany not only was involved with setting up these cartel agreements, but how it used them very effectively for economic warfare.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. Long article-length descriptions of the For the Record programs are available at SpitfireList.com, also featuring information that wasn't in the original program due to the limitations of time.
What we're going to do now is to go back to For the Record program number 372, recorded in August of 2002, and we're going to listen to some information from yet another of those books that is available for download for free on the SpitfireList.com website, All Honorable Men by James Stewart Martin. Martin was in charge of the economic warfare section of the antitrust division of the Department of Justice. Before, during, and after World War II, he was charged with helping to neutralize and then break up these American-German cartel agreements. He was frustrated. He was defeated in his effort to do so by American industry and finance. However, James Stewart Martin, for background, goes into the formation of the cartel system, and in particular, the relationship between French and German heavy industry. This from, For the Record, 372, from August of 2002, and from All Honorable Men.
What we're going to look at now is the book All Honorable Men. I've used this book in the past. It's authored by James Stewart Martin, who was in charge of the economic warfare section of the antitrust division of the Department of Justice in World War II, and then was in charge with the task of decartelizing not Germany after the fall of Hitler. He was, in fact, frustrated in his efforts to do that by some of the same Wall Street industrialists and financiers who had helped to build up Hitler in the first place, and, in fact, of the relationship between the Thyssen interests that you're going to hear about and between the Union Banking Corporation and the Bush family were one of the relationships that we've explored as not only giving rise to or helping to give rise to fascism in Germany, but also helping to move the engines of the Underground Reich in the post-World War II period. We took a look at that in For the Record 370. Now, of the relationship between the Comité de Forge and German industrialists of the Saar, the relationship between the iron ore of Lorraine and the coal of the Saar being a central one here, we're going to take a look at this structural relationship within which a conspiratorial process subverted and ultimately defeated France in World War II. James Stewart Martin's All Honorable Men, published by Little Brown and Company in 1950. The horizontal separation of private interests from government policies went even further, this, by the way, referring to France. The struggle of the interwar period, that means between World War I and World War II, the struggle of the interwar period was not simply a clash between French interests on the one side and German interests on the other. During the development of the Ruhr-Lorraine industrial complex, like-minded industrialists in France and Germany had become directors of jointly owned and jointly controlled financial, industrial, and distributing enterprises. In many cases, common views on questions of economic organization, labor policy, social legislation, and attitude toward government had been far more important to the industrialists than differences of nationality or citizenship. After 1870, the interdependence of the French and German iron and steel industries led the owners to work together despite national differences, although the private activities of the French owners were in many instances in direct opposition to French public policy. It is curious to note that only the French appeared to have this conflict between public policy and private activities. On the German side, complete coordination seems to have been preserved between national and private interests, between officials of the German Republic and the leaders of German industry and finance. During World War I, The De Vendels, the influential French-German banking and industrial family which headed the French wing of the international steel cartel through their Comité de Forge and whose members had sat in the parliaments of both France and Germany, were able to keep the French army from destroying industrial plants belonging to the German enterprises of the Rochling family. This is actually during World War I. These plants were located in the Briey Basin, a Lorraine ore field then in German control. The Rochling family, that's R-O-U-M-L-A-U-T, C-H-L-I-N-G, the Rochling family, with their powerful complex of coal, iron, steel, and banking enterprises in Germany, has for generations played in close harmony with the French De Vendel family. For a century, the descendants of Christian Rochling have dominated the industry and commerce of the Saar Basin. It was Hermann Rochling who arranged the return of the Saar to Germany in the plebiscite of January 1935 by organizing the Deutsche Front, which delivered 90% of the votes to the Nazis. Though 72 members of the Rochling family have survived two world wars and are still active in the business of the Saar today, two other members of the family, Hermann and his brother Robert, deserve a special place in history. During World War I, Hermann, a cavalry captain in the German army, and Robert, a major, had been put in charge of production in the Briey Basin. After the war, when the brothers Rochling moved out of the areas which had to be ceded to France under the treaty, the two of them carried away bodily a couple of large steel plants. Conceiving this grand larceny to be something in the nature of a war crime, the French government tried the brothers Rochling in absentia and sentenced them to 40 years in prison. But the German government never would give up the Rochlings to the French. For the next 22 years, the brothers were under this cloud as far as the French government was concerned. On the other hand, as far as the French Steelmakers Association, the Comité de Forge, and in particular the De Vendels who headed the committee were concerned, business as usual, or in this case, business as unusual, prevailed. In the end, even the French government weakened for business purposes, though the war crime sentence remained. When it came time for France to build its impregnable Maginot Line, who should be called in to supply steel and technical assistance but the German firm of the brothers Rochling? If the French behaved in this case, as did the Americans during World War II in the case of insurance coverage on war plants, they doubtless placed plenty of guards to protect the security and secrecy of the Maginot Line construction from the prying eyes of the general public, while the blueprints rested safely in the hands of the only people to whom they mattered, to wit, the enemy. Now comes the outbreak of World War II. The French army marching into the Saar during the phony war period in 1939 received orders not to fire on or damage the plants of the war criminals, unquote, the brothers Rochling. In 1940 came the Blitz and the fall of France. The Vichy government passed a decree exonerating the Rochlings and canceling their 40-year prison sentences. So note the relationship between the De Vendels and the Rochlings preserved the Rochlings in two world wars.
That again from For the Record 372 from August of 2002 and from James Stuart Martin's All Honorable Men, available for download for free on the SpitfireList.com website. What we're going to do now is to tie in the Franco-German aspect of the coal and iron and steel cartel with the international cartels that we discussed in Miscellaneous Archive Show M11 and that are written about extensively in All Honorable Men and other books available for download for free on the SpitfireList.com website. This concerns the formation of Vereinigte Stahlwerke, or in English, U.S. Steel. It is not the U.S. Steel Morgan, formerly Morgan-controlled interest, but rather a consortium of German steel companies. It later became Thyssen AG, one of the principal elements in the Bormann Flight Capital Network. Today, ThyssenKrupp is the largest a heavy industrial concern in Western Europe. It also, the Thyssen interests would had as their major touchstone in the U.S. the Bush family, George Herbert Walker and his son-in-law, Prescott Bush Sr., as we looked at in, among other programs, For the Record 370. So once again, from For the Record 372 and All Honorable Men, about how the Franco-German coal, iron, and steel cartel fit into the larger picture of the cartels that were established as part of the globalization that took place between the two world wars.
Now, turning again to the book All Honorable Men by James Stewart Martin that we used in the first half of this broadcast, James Stewart Martin, one of the key people in charge with it attempting to interdict some of the U.S.-German industrial relationships, some of these structural relationships, which in turn hampered the U.S. war effort and which not only were central to the German war effort, but which helped to bring about fascism in Germany in the first place by lending key support to Adolf Hitler in the 1932 election. When discussing the relationship between the French Comité de Forges and the de Wendel family and the Rauchling family in Germany, whom they aided against French national interest in both World War I and World War II, bear in mind that in turn this structural relationship between the French steelmakers and industrialists and the German coal producers and industrialists in Germany and the German Steel Trust, bear in mind that our German steel cartel, I should say, bear in mind that the financing of Vereinigte Stahlwerke, or United Steel, the Thyssen firm that we're going to hear about, that came from the United States and the development capital, the venture capital to combine the German steel interests, in turn linked to their counterparts in France. This came from the United States. And note that William Draper was in charge of the economic reconstruction of Germany. He also, in addition to helping to finance German heavy industry and Third Reich industry in the first place, he also was very close to the elder George Bush. His son, William Draper III, helped to finance the younger George Bush's business ventures, and his son, Tim Draper, is a Silicon Valley venture capitalist who has been very active on behalf of school voucher initiatives here in California. So it's all in the family. But of the Thyssen, Draper, German steel interest relationship to the Wall Street financiers, James Stewart Martin writes as follows. The mid-20s were remarkable for German industrial combination. They marked the formation of the United Steelworks in Germany, or Vereinigte Stahlwerke, as a combination of the four biggest steel producers, Ernst Pungsen, Fritz Thyssen, again a partner of the Bush family, Otto Wolff, and the others who drew this combine together had managed to get over $100 million from private investors in the United States. I would note that $100 million in the 1920s was a huge, huge sum of money. Continuing. Dillon Reed and Company, the New York investment house which brought Clarence Dillon, James V. Forrestal, William H. Draper Jr., by the way a close Bush family ally, and others into prominence, floated the United Steelworks bonds in the United States behind a glowing prospectus which declared that the United Steelworks Corporation, or Vereinigte Stahlwerke, quote, will be the largest industrial unit in Europe, and one of the largest manufacturers of iron and steel in the world, ranking in productive capacity second only to United States Steel Corporation, unquote. The formation of United Steel, or Vereinigte Stahlwerke, gave its management tremendous power in Germany, enough to carry through without delay the organization of the German domestic steel cartel, and to guarantee the good behavior, unquote, of all German steel companies in their agreements with foreign firms. So again, note the relationship here of some of the Thyssen Bush relationships that we've discussed in the past, and of course bear in mind the connections between the Thyssen Axis and the Bormann Organization, or Underground Reich, as I call it.
That again, For the Record 372 from August 2002, and also from All Honorable Men. Now, the Franco-German economic axis, which is the dominant element in not only Franco-German, but European continental relationships and political derivative political relationships to this day, that was maintained in the post-war period through the remarkable and deadly Bormann flight capital network, about which I speak so often.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. You can subscribe to the comments posted on the SpitfireList.com website, most of them by a brilliant contributing editor who uses the moniker Terra Fractal, specializing, but by no means exclusively, in economic and financial matters.
Turning to Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile by Paul Manning, again, another of the books available for download for free from the SpitfireList.com website, about the role of French banks in hoping to transfer and invest Nazi money in such a way as to put it into various French colonies and where it was invested for German for further German use. The 4DJ, four Paris banks, Vems AC, Bank de Paris et de Pays-Bas, Bank de l'Indochine, that's Indochina in English, now with Aide de Suez added to its name, and Banque Nationale pour le Commerce et l'Industrie, now Banque Nationale de Paris, were used by Bormann to siphon German Nazi Party and other German money to in France to their bank branches in the French colonies, where it was safeguarded and invested for its German ownership. I wonder what role that may have played in helping to set the stage for the American involvement in Vietnam, formerly part of French Indochina. Might that have had some, might that Bormann Nazi money invested in Indochina have had anything to do with that? I think it's an element of speculation. Now, in Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, Paul Manning goes into the pre-war collaboration between German industry and finance and the French economic oligarchs or kingpins. Again, we have spoken about that in our last program and in this one, and it is one of the foundational elements of the development of the French Fifth Column, which manifested ultimately during the war in the Vichy collaborationist government. It has manifested after the war in the manner or in the form of a German slash underground Reich economic fifth column, which dominates French politics and economic matters to this day. Of the collaboration between German and French industry and finance, Paul Manning writes in Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, in the years before the war, the German businessmen, industrialists, and bankers had established close ties with their counterparts in France. After the Blitzkrieg and invasion, the same Frenchmen in many cases went on working with their German peers. They didn't have much choice, to be sure, and the occupation being instituted, very few in the high echelons of commerce and finance failed to collaborate with the German occupiers. The Third Republic's business elite was virtually unchanged after 1940 and the German occupation of France, skipping down. They, the French industrialists and financiers, they regarded the war and Hitler as an unfortunate diversion from their chief mission of preventing a communist revolution in France. Anti-Bolshevism was a common denominator linking these Frenchmen to Germans, and it accounted for a volunteer French division, the Charlemagne Division, on the Eastern Front. The upper-class men who had been superbly trained in finance and administration at one of the two Grand Corps schools were referred to as France's permanent wall of money, unquote, and as professionals, they came into their own in 1940. They agreed to the establishment of German subsidiary firms in France and permitted a general buy-in to French companies. These last couple of sentences again. The upper-class men who had been superbly trained in finance and administration at one of the two Grand Corps schools were referred to as France's permanent wall of money, and as professionals, they came into their own in 1940, i.e. when the Germans conquered France. They agreed to the establishment of German subsidiary firms in France and permitted a general buy-in to French companies. And this continued during and after World War II, again from Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile. Society's natural survivors, French version, who had served the Third Reich as an extension of German industry, would continue to do so in the period of post-war trials, just as they had survived the war, the occupation, and the liberation. These were many of the French elite, the well-born, the property, the titled, the experts, industrialists, businessmen, bureaucrats, and bankers. Economic collaboration in France with the Germans had been so widespread on all levels of society that there had to be a realization that an entire nation could not be brought to trial. Only a few years before, there had been many a sincere and well-meaning Frenchman, as in Belgium, England, and throughout Europe, who believed National Socialism to be the wave of the future. Indeed, the only hope for curing the many desperate social, political, and economic ills of the time. France, along with other occupied countries, did contribute volunteers for the fight against Russia. Then there were many other Frenchmen, the majority, who resignedly felt there was no way the Germans could be pushed back across the Rhine. And still more about the post-war German economic control and resultant political control in France from Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile. The characteristic secrecy surrounding the actions of German industrialists and bankers during the final 9 months of the war, when Bormann's flight capital program held their complete attention, was also carried over into the post-war years when they began pulling back the skeins of economic wealth and power that stretched out to neutral nations of the world and to formerly occupied lands. There was a suggestion of this in France. Flora Lewis, F-L-O-R-A, last name L-E-W-I-S, writing from Paris in the New York Times of August 28, 1972, told of her conversation with a French publisher, quote, "It would not be possible to trace ownership of corporations and the power structure as in the U.S. They, unquote, would not permit it. They, unquote, would find a way to hound and torture anyone who tried," commented the publisher. "They, unquote, seem to be a fairly small group of people who know each other, but many are not at all known to the public. They, unquote, move in and out of government jobs, but public service apparently serves to win private promotion rather than the other way around. The government control, unquote, that practically everyone mentions cannot be traced to stockholdings, regulatory agencies, public decisions. It seems to function through a maze of personal contacts and tacit understandings," unquote. The understandings arrived at in the power structure of France reached back to pre-war days, were continued during the occupation, and have carried over to the present time. Lewis, in her report from Paris, commented further, "This hidden control of government and corporations has produced a general unease in Paris." Again, this is August of 72. Along with the unease, the fact that France has lingering and serious social and political ailments is a residue of World War II and of an economic occupation that was never really terminated with the withdrawal of German troops beyond the Rhine at the end of the war. It was this special economic relationship between German and French industrialists that made it possible for Friedrich Flick to arrange with the De Vendel steel firm in France for purchase of his shares in his rural coal combine for $45 million, which was to start him once more on the road back to wealth and power after years in prison following his conviction at Nuremberg. West Germany, this, by the way, Manning was writing, the book was published in 1981, well before the end of the Cold War and German reunification. West Germany's economic power structure is fueled by a two-tier system. The corporations and individuals who publicly represent the products that are common household names around the world, and the secretive groups operating in the background as holding companies, and who pull the threads of power in overseas corporations established during the Bormann tenure in the Third Reich. As explained to me, these threads are like the strands of a spider's web, and no one knows where they lead except the inner circle of the Bormann organization in South America. And note that just as in the segment from For the Record 372, in which James Stewart Martin was talking about the relationship between the De Vendels and their Comité des Forges and the Roeckling steel interests in Germany, so too the De Vendels helped another German member of that coal, iron, and steel cartel, the Flick family of Friedrich Flick, to once again reinstitute his economic or his industrial empire in the Ruhr. So once again, we see the De Vendel family and their role in this cartel arrangement between the French and the Germans. We should also note that the same sort of relationship that is described here also existed between powerful American industrial and financial interests, such as the Bush family and their counterparts in Germany. We have spoken about that many times. Now, amidst all of the brouhaha about Russian meddling in various elections, including our own, it now turns out that the French election, in which Russia has certainly been pulling for Marine Le Pen, because basically Marine Le Pen ostensibly at least is anti-EU and wants to pull France out of the EU. Putin, in what I see basically as something of a recapitulation of the Hitler-Stalin pact, not that Stalin had been converted to Nazism, but in an attempt at breaking the encirclement of the former Soviet Union, he literally signed a deal with the devil, that being the Hitler-Stalin pact. It did not, although it gave Stalin territories in the east, the Baltic states, Bessarabia, now called Moldova, and parts of Poland. Ultimately, it was a deal with the devil, and the Soviet Union got invaded anyway. Note here, though, that, again, the dynamic of having, being in the knickers of both sides of a political debate. Just imagine you're playing chess. If you could determine five of your opponent's key moves, you're going to checkmate your opponent every time. And again, we have taken a look at the French Vichy and fascist roots of the Front National. Now, because the Le Pen forces are anti-EU, France is backing Emmanuel Macron.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. All of Dave Emery's 36 years of work is available for download on the SpitfireList.com website. The site includes many articles not included in the programs, as well as a small library of old anti-fascist books. All of the material on the website is available for free. Sister station WFMU is podcasting the For the Record programs. To subscribe to the podcast, use the link at the top of the description for this program or on the front page.
And again, the post-war French-German axis should be seen at the foundation of what I'm about to read. From the German foreign policy blog, which feeds along the lower right-hand side of the front page of the SpitfireList.com website, We read the following from April 24th of 2017. This from an article, France's Elections. Berlin's favorite candidate took the lead in the first round in Sunday's French presidential elections. According to the latest predictions, Emmanuel Macron won with 23.4% of the votes, followed by Marine Le Pen of the National Front with 22.6%. Macron is expected to win the May 7th runoffs. Initially, the German government had banked on and openly promoted the conservative candidate François Fillon. However, after his approval ratings significantly dropped in the polls due to the scandal over high payments to his wife as his parliamentary assistant, Berlin was forced to turn to Macron. Like Fillon, Macron is considered Germany-compatible, unquote, by a German think tank, whereas all other candidates are viewed as unsuitable for, quote, constructive cooperation, unquote, because of their criticism of the EU and or of NATO. Recently, Germany's finance minister Wolfgang Schäuble ostentatiously recommended voting for Macron. Berlin's interference on behalf of Macron shows once again that German domination of the EU does not stop at national borders, and according to a well-known EU observer, surpasses by far Russia's feeble meddling in France. In the brief analysis published shortly before the first round of France's presidential elections, the German Council on Foreign Relations, or DGAP, examined the extent to which the presumed policy of the five most promising candidates would comply with German interests. Only two of them are really Germany compatible, unquote, the DGAP declared, again quoting Emmanuel Macron and François Fillon. Important aspects, unquote, of their positions, quote, coincide with those of the German government, the think tank analyzes. Both announced, quote, ambitious reform programs, unquote, whose implementation would be, quote, the prerequisite for joint initiatives in the framework of the economic and monetary union, unquote. Even though the existence of, quote, disagreements, unquote, cannot be denied, compromises are quite realistic. Concerning the socialist candidate Benoît Hamon, H-A-M-O-N, the DGAP criticized that he would like to, quote, rescind the Maastricht criteria and the related stability course, unquote. Jean-Luc Mélenchon, Parti de Gauche, and Marine Le Pen, Front National, even reject major elements of today's EU and France's integration into NATO. A, quote, constructive cooperation with them is thus, quote, difficult to imagine, unquote. Since the beginning of the year, Berlin has openly interfered in its neighboring country's election campaign by systematically supporting first Fillon and then Macron. In Berlin, objections had been initially raised against Fillon because he was seeking a certain alignment with Russia. But even as French experts assumed that Fillon would not be able to pursue such a policy against Berlin's will. Berlin, however, approved Fillon's plans to scrap the 35-hour work week once and for all, raise the retirement age to 65, deregulate the labor market, raise the value-added tax by 2%, and cut 500,000 French civil service jobs. This would amount to a complete alignment with the German austerity policy. In November 2016, the French business press reported that German finance minister Wolfgang Schäuble explicitly praised Fillon's electoral program. On January 23, 2017, Schäuble, defense minister Ursula von der Leyen, and Chancellor Angela Merkel held talks with Fillon in Berlin, thereby offering him the chance to present himself to the French public as the welcomed candidate of the EU's hegemon. Skipping down. Soon after that, however, the German government was obliged to change course because Fillon's approval ratings significantly dropped in the polls due to his scandal surrounding high payments to his wife and children as parliamentary assistants. Berlin then began backing Macron. On March 16th, Chancellor Merkel granted him an audience, and together with Foreign Minister Sigmar Gabriel, he appeared before the press in the German Foreign Ministry. On the evening of March 16th, a public panel discussion on the future for Europe was organized with Macron and the German philosopher Jürgen Habermas in the German capital to enhance the French candidate's prestige, which was also widely reported in the French media. Macron has not only shown his complete commitment to cooperation with Berlin in a Germany-dominated EU, he is also well remembered by the German government because during his term as France's Minister of the Economy, he had tackled the comprehensive deregulation of the labor market. Just recently, German Finance Minister Schäuble openly promoted Macron. And the entire article is in the written description for the record 957, which will be available shortly after the recording of this program. And the article concludes about the relative interference of Germany into elections and talking about the National Front and Trump. The interference into the French presidential election campaign demonstrates that German domination of the EU hardly knows borders. It also highlights that the threat of unprecedented interference emanating only from Russia is a propagandistic claim. On the weekend, the Brussels-based journalist Eric Bonse, B-O-N-S-E, a keen observer of the EU, noted that even though Russian President Vladimir Putin had received the far-right candidate Marine Le Pen for exclusive talks in Moscow, Le Pen's most obvious backing, however, was given by U.S. President Donald Trump when he praised her, quote, most determined stand, unquote, opposing jihadist terror. In addition, already in January, Le Pen had met with one of Trump's contact persons in New York. U.S. Congress members Steve King and Dana Rohrabacher, both Republicans, had traveled to Paris to meet with Le Pen in February of 2017. In view of the intensive German support for Macron, Bonse, or Biabons, B-O-N-S-E, who cannot be suspected of affinity either to Russia or to the Trump administration, concluded that all this is, quote, nothing compared to Germany's interference. The point being that as we take a look at the French political landscape, you have the foundations of the most virulent and criminal elements of the French Fifth Column and its resultant Vichy collaborationist government basically recapitulated in the National Front in France. Today, it is making a lot of political, minting a lot of valuable political currency with its anti-immigrant / anti-Muslim point of view. And I would note that the French left-wing parties are being encouraged to form what has been referred to in French political shorthand as the Republican Front, that they all are being encouraged to band together to vote against the National Front of Marine Le Pen. And Germany is polling again for the anti-Le Pen candidates because those will be most favorable to Germany. Note again that the Underground Reich has profound links to the National Front, just as they have, as I've looked at in so many of the Trump and Confabonder shows, they have profound links to Team Trump and the GOP as well. However, again, think about the dynamic I'm talking about. If you can get into both sides of a political debate or a political confrontation, you will win. And the French leftists are being encouraged to join with the center and voting for the German-favored candidate, Emmanuel Macron. and against the underground Reich and Vichy collaborationist extension of the National Front. Bearing in mind, again, that the French left has received a lot of financing from the underground Reich. Think the Mitterrand-Bousquet relationship, Mitterrand's role in helping, according to Robert Zoellick, establish the European Monetary Union and the Euro, thereby solidifying Germany's economic and political hegemony over Europe. That is something to think about. Now, again, from the Wikipedia entry on the National Front of France, it mentions that one of the central elements in generating the formation of the National Front is l'Action Française, founded by French Nazi collaborator Charles Marat. It was founded well before the Second World War, as we looked at in For the Record 951, and again last week in For the Record 956. Charles Marat is one of the main influences on Steve Bannon, one of Donald Trump's main advisors. We have looked so often about the profound underground Reich links to the Muslim Brotherhood. Bear in mind briefly that when fascism coalesced, it was during the colonial period and part of the international struggle between various fascist countries and their opponents on the Allied camp, took advantage of various anti-colonial movements and turned them into fascist elements, some of them anyway, abroad. Subhas Chandra Bose's Indian National Army, the Muslim Brotherhood, and other elements in the Islamic world and elsewhere were part of that fifth column. We've spoken about the Bank Al-Taqwa, its role in helping to finance Al-Qaeda, and its many links to international fascism, the SS, the Underground Reich, the Muslim Brotherhood, and the GOP. We're going to review briefly a passage from Dollars for Terror, the United States and Islam. We're going to talk about the former Turkish Prime Minister, Mr. Erbakan, E-R-B-A-K-A-N, first name N-E-C-M-E-T-T-I-N. His Rafal Party, basically a Turkish branch of the Muslim Brotherhood, for all intents and purposes, was the direct predecessor of the AKP party of Mr. Erdogan. Now, what we're going to look at here is the relationship between basically the patron, the forerunner of Erdogan in Turkey, and Ahmet Huber of the Bank Al-Taqwa. In turn, it was Ahmet Huber who introduced Mr. Erbakan to Jean-Marie Le Pen of the Front National in France, since replaced by his daughter, and they worked out an agreement. A second photograph in Huber's apartment, in which Hitler is talking with Himmler, hangs next to those of Necmettin Erbakan and Jean-Marie Le Pen, leader of the Fascist National Front. Erbakan, head of the Turkish Islamist Party, Rafah, turned to Ahmet Huber for an introduction to the chief of the French Party of the Far Right. Exiting from the meeting, which took place in September of 1995, Huber's two friends supposedly stated that they, quote, share the same view of the world, unquote, and expressed, unquote, their common desire to work together to remove the last racist obstacles that still prevent the union of the Islamist movement with the National Right of Europe. The point being that we have Turkish Islamists and Muslim Brotherhood-linked elements forging a relationship between Mr. Erbakan, again the predecessor and something of the role model for Mr. Erdogan, and Jean-Marie Le Pen. Again, note getting into the knickers of both sides of a political confrontation. And even though this passage, written in 2000, talks about removing the racist obstacles between the Islamic fascists and the European French counterparts, note that they have something of overlapping interests. Long story made short, the French fascists, the Front National, are pointing and saying, look at those immigrants, look at those Muslims, look what they're doing in our country. We are your only hope. You side with us. And the Muslim Brotherhood fascists are pointing to the reactionaries in France and saying, and elsewhere as well, look at those infidels. You see, we told you they would never accept you. Your only hope is to side with us, support us, so that this Machiavellian gambit of getting on both sides of a political divide, whether it is right or left, and where you can channel the bitterness of French workers against Islam, against Muslims or Islamists, where you can channel fears of the French left about fascism into supporting the German-backed Mr. Macron, or whether you're talking about backing both Front National and Muslim Brotherhood elements, getting on both sides of a political divide is a good way of doing things. And bear in mind, again, that Steve Bannon obviously is a major factor behind the anti-Muslim / anti-immigrant stance of Donald Trump and company, similar to that of the Front National. Steve Bannon is very much loves basically shout Marat of l'Action Française, the antecedent of the Front National. And as is in the written description for this show, Steve Bannon also very much likes a French political novel called The Camp of the Saints, very anti-immigrant, that also is beloved by anti-immigrant forces in France as well. Again, I refer listeners to the written description for the program. This concludes For the Record program number 957, The National Front and French Deep Politics, part 2. This is being recorded on May 4th of the year 2017. I'm Dave Emery. Ciao.